From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, a victory for South Africa and the Palestinian people at the International Court of Justice.
The court considers that, with regard to the present situation, Israel must, in accordance with its obligations under the Genocide Convention, in relation to Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention.
State parties to the Genocide Convention will now have to act, starting with Israel's friends.
The states that are close to Israel that have influence there are going to be aware of their obligations to prevent genocide, given that they have some impact on Israel.
One of those friends is Canada, with famous double standards.
Canada, subsequent to the decision in the Russia case or the Myanmar case, said that the International Court of Justice is a pillar of the rules-based international order. We must comply with the decisions. All people must comply. Myanmar, Russia, all these nasty characters. But when Israel comes along and does things that are even worse, their position is diametrically opposed to the one that they took in the Myanmar case. These people have no shame.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Israeli lawyers may have thought they dodged a bullet at the International Court of Justice last Friday in The Hague, when the court ruled on South Africa's application against Israel under the 1948 Genocide Convention. Days after that ruling, the Israelis are certainly not uncorking champagne. In a virtually unanimous decision, the UN's Supreme Judicial Body delivered the lion's share of what South Africa had requested from the court. The core of that request, that an urgent injunction or provisional measures order be issued calling on Israel not to commit genocide in Gaza. That's precisely what the ICJ did. In doing so, it acknowledged the plausibility of South Africa's genocide charges. Court President Joan Donoghue, a former U.S. State Department official, delivered a withering summary of the situation Gaza's 2.3 million people face after 16 weeks of unrelenting Israeli violence. In her 45-minute presentation to a packed chamber of attorneys and diplomats, Donoghue quoted a host of senior UN officials, human rights experts, and the UN Secretary General himself, describing a situation in Gaza that looks, sounds, and smells like genocide. Here's Judge Joan Donoghue reading out the court's reasoning and its order last Friday.
The court considers that the civilian population in the Gaza Strip remains extremely vulnerable. It recalls that the military operation conducted by Israel after 7 October 2023 has resulted inter alia in tens of thousands of deaths and injuries and the destruction of homes, schools, medical facilities, and other vital infrastructure, as well as displacement on a massive scale. The court notes that the operation is ongoing and that the Prime Minister of Israel announced on 18 January 2024 that the war, I quote, will take many more long months, end of quote. At present, many Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have no access to the most basic foodstuffs, potable water, electricity, essential medicines, or heating. The World Health Organization has estimated that 15% of the women giving birth in Gaza Strip are likely to experience complications and indicates that maternal and newborn death rates are expected to increase due to the lack of access to medical care. In these circumstances, the court considers that the catastrophic humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is at serious risk of deteriorating further before the court renders its final judgment. The court recalls Israel's statement that it has taken certain steps to address and alleviate the conditions faced by the population in the Gaza Strip. The court further notes that the Attorney General of Israel recently stated that a call for intentional harm to civilians may amount to a criminal offense, including that of incitement, and that several such cases are being examined by Israeli law enforcement authorities. While such steps are to be encouraged, they are insufficient to remove the risk that irreparable prejudice will be caused before the court issues its final decision in the case. In light of the foregoing, the court considers that there is urgency in the sense that there is a real and imminent risk that irreparable prejudice will be caused to the rights found by the court to be plausible before it gives its final decision. The court concludes on the basis of the aforementioned considerations that the conditions required by its statute for it to indicate provisional measures are met. It is therefore necessary, pending its final decision, for the court to indicate certain measures in order to protect the rights claimed by South Africa that the court has found to be plausible. The court considers that, with regard to the present situation, Israel must, in accordance with its obligations under the Genocide Convention, in relation to Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A, killing groups members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. The court recalls that these acts fall within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention when they are committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part the group as such. The court further considers that Israel must ensure with immediate effect that its military forces do not commit any of the aforementioned acts. The court is also of the view that Israel must take measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to the members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. The court further considers that Israel must take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israel must also take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of Article 2 and Article 3 of the Genocide Convention against members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. Regarding the provisional measure requested by South Africa that Israel must submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to the order, the court recalls that it has the power, reflected in Article 78 of the Rules of Court, to request the parties to provide information on any matter connected with the implementation of any provisional measures it has indicated. In view of the specific provisional measures it has decided to indicate, the court considers that Israel must submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to this order within 1 month as from the date of this order. The report so provided shall then be communicated to South Africa, which shall be given the opportunity to submit to the court its comments thereon. The court recalls that its orders on provisional measures under Article 41 of the statute have binding effect and thus create international legal obligations for any party to whom the provisional measures are addressed. The court reaffirms that the decision given in the present proceedings in no way prejudges the question of the jurisdiction of the court to deal with the merits of the case or any questions related to the admissibility of the application or to the merits themselves. It leaves unaffected the right of the governments of the Republic of South Africa and the State of Israel to submit arguments in respect of these questions. The order then states that the court deems it necessary to emphasize that all parties to the conflict in the Gaza Strip are bound by international humanitarian law. It is gravely concerned about the fate of the hostages abducted during the attack in Israel on 7 October 2023 and held since then by Hamas and other armed groups, and calls for their immediate and unconditional release.
International Court of Justice President Joan Donahue reading out the World Court's provisional measures order against Israel on Friday, January 26th in The Hague. Minutes after the court session, I reached out to Canadian international law professor and genocide scholar William Schabas. I reached William Schabas in London.
I think it's a very great achievement for South Africa to win this order. I think it's a very, very important order. It not only does it call for Israel not to do things, but it calls on Israel to do a number of things, including to provide immediate and effective measures to provide urgently needed basic services. And they talk about the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza. So this is very, very, very important order, and Israel's going to have to report on it in 1 month. And South Africa will see what they've reported. So it means that the court remains seized of this order. And that's another important part of it. It's an ongoing issue. If the court didn't think that there was a serious situation, it wouldn't have made such an order. I think the other remarkable thing about it is how unanimous it is. So there are the Israeli judge, Barak, the ad hoc judge, does not agree with some of the orders, although he does agree with others. But for some of them, he votes against them, but he's alone, or I should say he's supported by one other judge, the Ugandan judge, Julius Sebutindi. The rest of them are unanimous, and that, too, is an absolutely remarkable achievement. It's not the first time it's happened at the court, but this is a very, very sensitive and controversial issue, and I think if you were to get, 14 of your friends together in a room and say, can we agree on a statement about Israel and Palestine, unless you live in a little cocoon, you would have real trouble getting that agreement.
The court did not order a halt or a ceasefire.
That was a huge ask, and it was difficult. It wasn't asked to order a ceasefire. It was asked only to order a halt to its military activity in Gaza. And this was going pretty far. I mean, with Ukraine 2 years ago, the court ordered Russia to cease its military activity inside Ukraine because obviously it was in another country and it had no right to be there. But this is different. This is an occupied territory, and where Israel, it had some cause for a response following the 7th of October. And so ordering it to stop all military activity when missiles are being fired into Israel from Gaza, it's asking an awful lot of the court to make such an order. I'm not surprised that they didn't do it. People think they might have reformulated it otherwise, and perhaps South Africa could have shown them how to do that as well.
What will be the impact, Bill Schabas, of this ruling? I mean, normally the Security Council would take positive measures in response to an ICJ ruling, but of course it's unlikely to do so because of the veto. What impact is this provisional measures order going to have amongst Israel's other allies? Like, I'm thinking specifically about these five countries, European countries and Canada, that wrote their declarations of the court in mid-November, and countries across the global south.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how they react to it. I wouldn't rule out the possibility of a Security Council resolution. I think this is, given the unanimity, the near unanimity of the decision, I don't think it's out of the question that there could be a Security Council resolution, perhaps with a few abstentions. Maybe the U.S. and the U.K. would abstain in such a resolution, but they would let it through. If I were a member of the Security Council, I'd be busy drafting a resolution that will take this order into account. I wouldn't rule that out. And as for the conduct of other states, they're going to feel the states that are close to Israel that have influence there are going to be aware of their obligations to prevent genocide, given that they have some impact on Israel. I think most countries in the global south assume they have no impact whatsoever on Israel's behavior. But there are other countries that will feel this, and this will energize those within the country who expect their governments to do things to prevent genocide, to take positions with Israel, and so on.
Justice Donahue's comments were, of course, on behalf of the court, and she was reading from the order. But boy, the comments were stinging. They were withering. She quoted all sorts of UN officials, the UN Secretary General. She quoted Yoav Galant and his various seemingly genocidal comments. How would you describe the tone of the presentation by the court?
Well, the court, in making a provisional measures order, in principle, is not ruling on the merits, although it does have to make conclusions about certain factual things. And it's clear from the as you point out, some of the things that they draw people's attention to, it's their way of sending a message that they consider the situation in Gaza to be totally unacceptable. And their scope, it's not as if they're not like a doctor who's coming in and telling them all the things that are wrong with what they're doing. They have to frame what they're saying within the scope of the Genocide Convention and the acts of genocide that are listed in the convention. But that being said, it's a very, very powerful message.
William Schabas is a professor of international law at Middlesex University and professor of international humanitarian law and human rights at Leiden University. Read more about South Africa's application to the International Court of Justice under the 1948 Genocide Convention and the court's provisional measures order at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. In search of further wisdom about last Friday's ICJ ruling in South Africa versus Israel, the GPM reached out to Dimitri Lascaris, a lawyer, human rights activist, and journalist based in Montreal and southern Greece. Hello, Dimitri Lascaris. Welcome once again to the Green Planet Monitor.
Dr. Kattenberg, always a pleasure to speak to you.
Dimitri, tell me what your assessment is, your quick assessment of Friday's decision order by the International Court of Justice, issuing six provisional measures orders in the case South Africa versus Israel over the Genocide Convention. What's your quick assessment of this order?
It's a crushing defeat for Israel. It's a massive victory for South Africa, but for above all the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people. The only issue here is, how are we going to implement this decision? That's the real issue, and that's a very difficult issue. But on paper, as a matter of law, is this a stunning victory for South Africa and the Palestinian people? Absolutely, 100%. The court rejected everything that Israel said. Israel denied that the court had jurisdiction. The court rejected that. Israel denied that there was plausible evidence that it was committing the requisite acts under Section 2 of the Genocide Convention. The court rejected that. Israel argued that there was no evidence of genocidal intent, as it's defined in Section 2 of the Genocide Convention. The court not only rejected that, but said there's enough evidence to issue provisional measures. And the court, furthermore, gave essentially not in every respect, but the vast majority from a substantive perspective of what South Africa sought as provisional measures, it got. And finally, there was the proportion of the judges who voted in support of South Africa's position on all of these issues versus those who didn't. I mean, I was very, very confident that South Africa was going to win this, but even I never imagined that every single one of the Western judges would side with South Africa, including both the German judge and the American judge, who was a State Department official under Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. And we all know how pro-Israel Hillary Clinton is. So this is just an absolutely stunning rebuke of Israel and a tremendous victory by South Africa, but above all, by the Palestinian people.
So four of the six orders passed by a vote of 15-2, and the other two provisional measures orders passed by a vote of 16-1. I mean, the court passed by an overwhelming majority all six provisional measures order, but there was no ceasefire order. South Africa's number one requested provisional measure was that Israel be ordered to immediately suspend its warfare in Gaza. That was not amongst the provisional measures order. How do you take that?
I think it's a distinction without a difference. I'm going to read to you the language that matters. I mean, all of the provisional measures matter for different reasons. But the one relating to the hostilities reads as follows. Israel must take all, I repeat, all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, which defines genocide. In particular, A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D, imposing measures intended to prevent births. And then the court said, Israel must ensure with immediate effect that its military forces do not commit any of the described acts. I can't imagine language more sweeping and unequivocal than this. And let me just point out a couple of features of this language. First of all, it's addressed to Israel. It's not addressed to the belligerents. It's not addressed to Hamas. So it's telling Israel unconditionally. In other words, you have to do this irrespective of anything that anybody else, including Hamas or Islamic Jihad, does.
Because, of course, Hamas is, needless to say, not a party to the Genocide Convention, and it's not a party to the, wasn't a party to the application to the ICJ.
And it's not a state.
It's not a state.
The ICJ deals with disputes between states. So there was a perfectly, you know, valid legal reason why this was not addressed to Hamas. But the fact is, whatever the reason, it's not addressed to Hamas.
So this was a ceasefire, I've heard it said, it's been told to me. This was a ceasefire order without really ordering for a ceasefire.
Yeah, but one other thing I have to point out before I answer your question, David, is that the killing, the cessation of killing, maiming, traumatizing, covers the members of the group. That's what the court said. Who are the members of the group? The members of the group is Palestinians in Gaza. So the court, that's all Palestinians in Gaza. The court didn't distinguish between quote unquote innocent Palestinians and culpable Palestinians. The members of the group are all Palestinians in Gaza. So what the court is saying here is you must stop now killing, maiming, and traumatizing all Palestinians in Gaza. How is that not a unilateral ceasefire? It is clearly a prohibition on any further use of force that has the effect of killing, maiming, or traumatizing Palestinians in Gaza. An absolute unconditional prohibition. This is better than a ceasefire.
And the amazing thing is, perhaps the most remarkable, shout-provoking provisional measures order was that Israel has to report back to the ICJ in 30 days and provide a progress report. I mean, the question is, will it do it?
That's very important what you just said. It places Israel in a massive quandary. Because if Israel comes back, it just says that we're not going to report to you, then it's clearly violating the court's order. And it's also going to raise a very serious question of why aren't you reporting back? If you were innocent of any wrongdoing, why wouldn't you come forward and tell the court what you've done? Now, if it comes back and it reports, we killed Palestinians. But guess what? They were used by Hamas as human shields, and we only killed people who are from Hamas. That's not going to fly, because the court already listened to that argument, the human shields argument, we are taking all measures necessary to minimize the civilian casualties. Yes, there are some, but that can't be helped. The court has rejected all of that and ruled that out as an excuse. So they're going to have to come back. For them to comply with this provision, they're going to have to come back with a report within 30 days. And what they're going to have to report, honestly, is that they didn't kill or maim or traumatize anybody in Gaza. That's what they're going to have to report. And they've already violated that, David. They did that in the last 24 hours. They're already in severe violation of this order. And there's no way to avoid admitting that to the court other than not filing a report, which would be a flagrant violation of the order.
Now, another interesting thing about all this that I've not really heard anybody talk about is that, to my knowledge, this is the first time ever in the state of Israel's, 76-year history that it's presented itself to a court, indeed the highest legal tribunal in the world. Israel has never defended itself or allowed itself to be questioned before a court. And so when those six battery of Israeli lawyers were sitting there at the Peace Palace, I thought, this is amazing. They're sitting before 17 justices. They've never done this before. And now they're told, you got to come, you know, they came back for the ruling, and now they got to come back in 30 days. This is remarkable, I think.
I totally agree. I mean, this takes away the argument that we weren't there to defend ourselves, and therefore this court's decision is not reflective of the facts. They decide, I was rather surprised. I mean, of course, as you said, they have a longstanding practice of avoiding participation in any international tribunal that is assessing their conduct.
I mean, they don't let special rapporteurs into the country. They don't let special investigating commissions to come visit. They've imposed a sweeping ban on, I think, all human rights officials. They will not be judged. They will not allow themselves to be judged. But here they are sitting at the International Court of Justice.
Yeah, and you know, Dave, I've asked myself why they suddenly changed their approach to the international legal system. Again, this is pure speculation on my part. It's the only thing that makes any sense to me. Is that they believed, wrongly obviously, that a majority of the judges on this court were going to be inclined to reject South Africa's position. And so they believed, you know, that the system was basically rigged in their favor in advance, that the U.S. would be able to, you know, coerce, cajole, pressure the court into ruling in Israel's favor, that there were enough Western judges, like, you know, the president, who is, as I said, a former State Department official, like the German judge. We all know how obsequious the German government is towards Israel. You know, the Japanese judge, the Slovakian judge, and all the rest. And I guess maybe they calculated that they were going to win this thing, and all they had to do was show up. Well, man, they couldn't have been more wrong.
Dmitry, genocide. It's really hard to prove genocide because it's very hard to prove intent, and the core of genocide is intent. Dolus specialis. You've got to have specific intent to commit genocide. You can commit all manner of war crimes, you know, killing people, disproportionate violence, collective punishment, forced displacement, targeting hospitals, ambulances. But these are grave war crimes under international humanitarian law, but they don't add up to genocide. You've got to prove specific intent. It's a very high bar, isn't it? And there's all sorts of commentary. It's interesting that in a couple of these, in Aharon Barak's statement, Aharon Barak said, in my view, the appropriate legal framework for analyzing the situation in Gaza is international humanitarian law, not the Genocide Convention. And Judge Sebutinde, Ugandan, thus, while it is not inconceivable that grave violations of international humanitarian law amounting to war crimes or crimes against humanity could have been committed in Gaza, the court has no jurisdiction over IHL, only genocide. So there's two questions here. Genocide, it's a really high bar to prove. But at the same time, look at what Israel's doing. Even Israel's supporters acknowledge that what it's doing is really potentially in gross violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is not genocide, but it's pretty bad.
Well, it can be both, right? It can be both genocide and crimes against humanity and war crimes. But basically, the language you just quoted to me, David, is sort of, to put it to you in non-technical terms, it's legal gobbledygook. What they're really saying in fancy sort of theoretical way is they don't believe the evidence is sufficient to justify the granting of relief that South Africa has requested, and particularly on the question of intent. The problem that they have is that Israel seems to have, Israel's leaders right across the mainstream of the political elite in Israel, and also major figures in the media, the punditry, They seem to be hell-bent on incriminating themselves. The language that they're using, David, is absolutely astonishing. Typically, when people engage in war crimes, crimes against humanity, they have the good sense to try to obscure what their goal is. There has been no real effort made on the part of Israeli leaders to obscure what their goal is. They cited, this to me was an incredibly damning moment in the court's delivery of its reasons. They cited as three examples of evidence of genocidal intent a statement by the president of Israel, who, to his great disgrace, Isaac Herzog, said at the very outset that there are, essentially what he said, there are no innocents in Gaza. They're all responsible, laying the theoretical framework for the mass slaughter of Palestinian civilians, and most of whom are women and children. Then you have Yoav Gallant, the defense minister. I mean, my God, I can't think of a more obvious expression of genocidal intent. He says, we're fighting human animals. I'm lifting all restrictions on the military in its offensive, all restrictions, and we are going to deprive these people, these human animals, of food, water, electricity, and fuel. How is that not the communication of an intention to destroy all or part of the population of Gaza? I mean, give me a break, man. And, you know, and this is just three examples out of page after page of evidence put forward by South Africa of genocidal intent. And by the way, there were many statements made by Israeli officials after they filed the application. It was amazing to behold as a lawyer. They're confronted now by a claim of genocide before the highest court in the United Nations system, and they're still putting out these statements. So to give you one example, the Minister of Finance, I believe it's Smotrich who's the Minister of Finance, after the genocide application was filed, said publicly, it was on a, he was doing an interview, he said he referred to the people in Gaza as 2 million Nazis. 2 million Nazis. Of course, one half of the population of Gaza is children. This man was saying unequivocally that he regards the children of Gaza as Nazis.
But he's not responsible for the IDF. So the argument is that genocidal intent has to be expressed explicitly by individuals who are in command positions or who have the direct ability to influence soldiers on the ground, people who are actually making war-fighting decisions. And like Katz and the tourism minister and Smotrich, they don't fit that bill.
He's a member of the war cabinet. How does he not fit that bill? Ultimately, direction for the conduct of this campaign is coming from the war cabinet. He's a member. Not only is he a member, but he has the ability to bring down the government. Netanyahu's ability to control the government, to maintain a government, depends upon the far-right ministers in his cabinet, of whom Smotrich is one. When he has that kind of leverage over Netanyahu, who is the commander-in-chief of this entire decrepit, sadistic operation, you're telling me that he doesn't have the ability to influence how the military conducts its campaign? But again, let's ignore that. What about Netanyahu, the commander-in-chief, the supreme commander, the prime minister of the country, saying that Israel is going to turn Gaza into a deserted island? He said this at the outset, and then invoking the biblical figure of Amalek, an enemy of the Israelites, who were supposed to be killed, who were summoned by God to be killed en masse, including the children and the women. And he did this twice, Netanyahu. And in an incredibly powerful moment during the hearing, the South African team played a video of dozens of Israeli soldiers chanting in Gaza the name of Amalek with the devastation of the civilian infrastructure in the background. So they showed a direct line from Netanyahu's, the commander-in-chief's, invocation of the legend or the myth of Amalek to the conduct of the soldiers on the ground. I mean, this is not evidence of genocidal intent. Give me a break.
And now I'm looking at an article right now in The Intercept, a piece in The Intercept by Ryan Grimm, December 3rd. This circulated in the media, and I think The Intercept, well, it first was released in this right-wing Netanyahu-associated publication in Israel, and it was picked up by The Intercept. Netanyahu's goal for Gaza, thin the population to a minimum. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has tasked his top advisor, Ron Dermer, the Minister of Strategic Affairs, with designing plans to, quote, thin the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip to a minimum. Ah, sounds like destroying a population.
You know, and we could go on and on. You know, we're just talking about a few examples here. You know, there was the heritage minister who said that nuking Gaza was an option. Was he removed from his post? No, he's still there. He's still a key player in the war cabinet. You know, figure after figure of people in the Knesset saying we're going to destroy Gaza. We're going to expel all the people from Gaza, all the Palestinians. We're going to turn it into a parking lot. I mean, look, David, if the evidence here doesn't evince a genocidal intent, then there is no case. There is really no case in which anybody could prove genocidal intent. That's how obvious it is.
Dmitry, where will the impact of this order be felt the most?
So before, very importantly, about 2 days before the decision was issued, a poll came out which showed that 35% of Americans think Israel is committing genocide. And only 36% believed that they aren't committing genocide. The rest were undecided. And it was something in excess of 50% of Democrats said that Israel is committing genocide. Now that this decision has come out, all those pundits out there who have been saying that this claim, you know, John Kirby saying that there's meritless, there's no basis whatsoever to this. Well, they've just been blown out of the water by the fact that the ICJ voted 15-2 in support of the proposition, including, as I said, all the Western judges, the American president, and all the Western judges, that it is plausible that Israel's committing genocide. What this almost certainly means is that the level of belief in that proposition in the United States is going to go up quite significantly, perhaps even dramatically.
But these six provisional measures, they're binding in theory.
Yes.
But the ICJ has no way to enforce them. The only way to enforce preliminary measures, strictly speaking, is for the measures to come before the Security Council to be fashioned into a resolution, a sharply toothed resolution at the Security Council. And it's hard to imagine that happening. Bill Shabas was saying to me, Bill Shabas, Canadian legal scholar, genocide scholar, that he can imagine a resolution coming before the council that the United States and the UK would simply abstain on. But it's hard to imagine anything with teeth being passed at the Security Council, which is the only place that the provisional measures order can actually be enforced, if you will. So how do you see this being enforced?
Well, that's why I started out by talking about public opinion, because there's a sort of legal enforcement, which is what you're talking about, and you've accurately described sort of what would have to happen next at the collective level. There would have to be a resolution from the Security Council, adopting enforcement measures. And I totally agree with you, David. I'm skeptical that's going to happen because of the American-British veto. But there are other ways that this could end up being implemented. One is, enormous public pressure on the Biden administration, without whose support Israel simply cannot continue. And this decision is going to really complicate the ability of the Biden administration to continue supporting Israel militarily and economically. But also there is individual enforcement. So the UN Security Council is the collective enforcement mechanism, but national governments can enforce this to some degree. They can do it by imposing an arms embargo on Israel. They can do it by severing diplomatic relations on Israel. They can do it by imposing economic sanctions on Israel. They can do it by prosecuting Israeli war criminals in their domestic courts, indicting them. So there's all sorts of tools available at the national level, not just at the supranational level. And I would be shocked if at least a substantial number of states, probably most of which will be outside of the West, will not adopt such measures.
And Article 1 of the Genocide Convention reads, the contracting parties, and there are like 153 contracting parties to the Genocide Convention, the contracting parties confirm that genocide, whether committed in time of peace or in time of war, is a crime under international law, which, here's the operative, which they undertake to prevent.
Correct.
And to punish, but to prevent, meaning genocide in the making. So all 153 parties are obliged under Article 1 of the convention to prevent genocide from happening in Gaza.
Absolutely. And in November of last year, you know, at which point the death toll, although shocking, was not nearly as high. The level of destruction of civilian infrastructure, which, although shocking, was not nearly as great. At that point in time, the International Commission of Jurists, 60 leading international judges, international law scholars, practitioners, put out a statement and reminded states about this obligation under Article 1 of the Genocide Convention that you've just referred to, and said that that obligation as a matter of law is triggered when there is a serious risk of genocide occurring. This decision has put to bed any question about whether there's a serious risk. The court has said it's plausible Israel's committing genocide, overwhelmingly said this. That means that the Article 1 obligation has unquestionably been triggered, and every single state signatory to the Genocide Convention now has an obligation to take positive measures to enforce the decision to stop the genocide. So one thing is clear, we can debate exactly what that means. What must these positive, is it an arms embargo? Is it a severing of diplomatic relations? So that's a discussion that can be had. But one thing is beyond dispute, David, and that is a business as usual approach to Israel is now off the table. You cannot claim as a national government that you're complying with your Article 1 obligation if you just continue to do business as usual. Something important has to change. You have to adopt some measures that are adverse to the interests of the state of Israel to be able to say credibly that you're complying with Article 1.
Dmitry, have you read this joint declaration of intervention filed in mid-November by Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and the UK vis-a-vis the Gambia versus Myanmar?
Yes, I did.
It's fascinating. And Bill Shaba said to me, right, I mean, this was filed with the ICJ in the Gambia versus Myanmar case a month and a half before South Africa filed its application. Probably these five countries had no idea Africa was about to do it. And in this intervention, they're calling on the court to broaden its construction, which is an interesting phrase. It's interpretation, it's reading of the Genocide Convention to critically really factor in the impact of wars on children, and think about all the children suffering in Gaza, and on forced displacement. And they were, of course, thinking about the displacement of the Rohingyas. And Bill Shabas was saying, you know, if they knew what they know now, these guys would not file this declaration in the Gambia versus Myanmar. They might even regret having done so, because they've just asked the court to broaden its interpretation of the Genocide Convention to take into account things that Israel is really doing in Gaza. And it's really hypocritical. It's really hypocritical, like Canada, which supports Israel, and Germany and France to perhaps a lesser extent. The Netherlands is selling, you know, F-35 parts to Israel. And so they're all stepping forward and saying to the ICJ, you really need to broaden your definition of genocide when it comes to Myanmar, but hands off Israel.
The hypocrisy, David, is now a galactic, epic. It's on a scale that is unimaginable. And I would point out, I mean, I certainly agree with Bill Shabas's, you know, observations about the Myanmar case, but I think even more astonishing that in terms of hypocrisy is the case against Russia before the ICJ. Canada wholeheartedly supported the order of the ICJ that Russia cease its military operations in Ukraine. And, you know, spoke glowingly about that decision. In Ukraine, according to the UN, in 2 years of hostilities, less than 600 children have been killed, which is obviously, you know, a terrible toll, death toll on children. In Gaza, they killed over 20 times as many children in 3 months. In 3 months, David. And we have our government saying we don't accept the premise of the South African application and not welcoming the decision, not assuring the public it's going to implement the decision, where Israel killed more than 20 times as many children in 3 months as Russia has killed in Ukraine in 2 years. You think people don't know this? People know this. They understand this, especially in the non-Western world, and they are absolutely disgusted and appalled by the hypocrisy of the Canadian and other Western governments, and they should be.
So briefly, what was your thought about this joint declaration that these five countries filed? I mean, you read through it. It's kind of interesting. They're asking the court to broaden its interpretation of genocide, and it's talking about children and forced displacement.
Well, briefly, I don't think you can reconcile the position that they took in that paper, in that submission, with what they're doing now. These positions are radically inconsistent. Now they're effectively, you know, not doing this explicitly, but implicitly, they're urging the court to adopt a very narrow definition of genocide and to construe the Genocide Convention in a way that's most favorable to the accused. Their position is diametrically opposed to the one that they took in the Myanmar case. I mean, it's unbelievable. These people have no shame. So, as I said, you know, they talked about the court. I think Canada, not necessarily in that submission, but subsequent to the decision in the Russia case or the Myanmar case, said that the International Court of Justice is a pillar of the world-based, rules-based international order. We must comply with the decisions. All people must comply. Myanmar, Russia, all these nasty characters. But when Israel comes along and does things that are even worse, if you look at the actual statistics, the objective facts on the ground, even worse than what we've seen in Myanmar, even worse than what we've seen in Ukraine. And they're telling us, we don't accept the premise of this, and we are going to continue to support Israel. I think they've lost all credibility on the world stage. At this stage, the only people who take the Canadian and other Western governments seriously when it comes to human rights and international law are, you know, a handful of people in the West who are hardcore neoconservative ideologues. Everybody else knows the reality of the situation now.
So how would you like to see Canada responding to the ICJ decision? And Canada, of course, you go to the website, Foreign Affairs Canada, they mention the ICJ's 2004 wall ruling. They acknowledge the legitimacy of the ruling, and they therefore consider Israel's wall to be unlawful. What should Canada be doing today to, as it says here in the Genocide Convention, to prevent? How should Canada be undertaking to prevent genocide from happening in Gaza?
There's plenty Canada can do. Number one, Canada should bar all deliveries of arms to Israel. Not just stop issuing permits for the exportation of arms to Israel, but actually block any deliveries under permits that have already been issued. Number two, Canada should expel Israel's ambassadors, sever diplomatic relations with Israel, which other countries have done. Canada should bar any of its citizens from serving in the Israeli military and state unequivocally that anybody who flouts that prohibition is going to be prosecuted under the criminal laws. Canada should end the charitable treatment of organizations that advocate for Israel in this country, or that are funneling money directly or indirectly to institutions of the Israeli state. Canada should indict under its own war crimes legislation, now embodied in the criminal code, Israeli war criminals. Those are all things Canada can do and more. And Canada has done none of those things. Canada is not indicating the slightest intention of doing any of those things, which means that Canada at this moment is flagrantly violating its obligations under the Genocide Convention.
I mean, Canada, along with a whole lot of other countries like the UK, obviously the United States, Germany, Netherlands, you name them, all the Western powers, they say this is a conflict of a historical, political, ancient nature that has to be addressed, and it can only be addressed through direct negotiation and compromise. It's a political issue that needs to be resolved politically, and international law just gets in the way. It not only gets in the way, it makes things worse.
Well, you could apply that argument to any armed conflict, I suppose, in the world, couldn't you? But Canada doesn't do that. When Canada feels it's useful to invoke international law to achieve its foreign policy objectives, which are essentially the foreign policy objectives of the United States government, it readily invokes international law. Secondly, quite apart from the hypocrisy of the Canadian government position, this is a legal issue. something can be political and legal at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive. So thirdly, this is exactly the approach that Canada has been taking and the Western community have been taking for decades, treating this as a quote-unquote political issue. And what has that gotten the Palestinian people? Do they have a state? No. What they have now are, what, 800,000 settlers, Israeli Jewish settlers living illegally in the West Bank, less sovereignty than they've ever had over the West Bank, certainly, you know, since Oslo. They, you know, in massive casualties, an apartheid system, as has been meticulously documented by B'Tselem and Yeshdin and Amnesty and Human Rights Watch. That's what, you know, 50 years of so-called political efforts to resolve this crisis for the Palestinian people have yielded for them. It's a miserable failure. And if we don't intervene in accordance with international law, this is just going to get worse for the Palestinian people.
But international law has also been a failure, right? I mean, earlier we were talking about, you know, forget genocide. We're seeing huge violations, grave breaches, war crimes, crimes against humanity under international humanitarian law. Not genocide, but just a whole lot of other things, which are crimes, grave crimes under the Rome Statute. And so the ICC should be responding, doing something. But Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor, seems to be doing nothing. And it is, in my mind, it's inconceivable that he would ever, ever issue arrest warrants against Israeli leaders. Now, you could say, no, maybe he will at someday he might. But I see that as being in some other universe. So what does this say? I don't know what you think, but what does this say about international law? And do you despair of the law?
Well, it's not the law that is problematic so much. It's the enforcement of the laws, that there isn't an adequate enforcement mechanism. And the basic reason for that, frankly, is because these decisions under the UN Charter have been vested in the Security Council, and five states have been granted permanent status and the veto power on the UN Security Council. That's the fundamental flaw, above all else, in the international legal architecture. These decisions should be enforced by the General Assembly. And that also needs to be reformed in one sense, and that is that the voting structure of the General Assembly is really profoundly anti-democratic, because you have a so-called state like Micronesia, which has, I don't know, tens of thousands of citizens. Its vote carries the same weight as that of China, with 1.4, 1.5 billion people. That doesn't make any sense. So it should be some method of weighted voting in the General Assembly that corresponds at least to some degree to the distribution of the human population. And the General Assembly should have the final word in terms of enforcement. It should have the power to enforce. And no one should have a veto. No one. If you want to have like some supermajority provision, okay, maybe that makes sense for certain fundamental issues. But to say that one state can block the enforcement of international law, even in the case of a genocide, is absolutely ludicrous, and that is the fundamental flaw in the international legal architecture.
So why should people, kind of coming to a close here, why should people who don't know very much about the law, but who feel very sympathetic towards the Palestinian people, or any people living under subjugation, experiencing racism, but they don't know anything about international law, it's kind of arcane. The International Court of Justice has been in the news with this provisional measures order. Why should people be interested in international law if it's so much of a dead letter, it seems?
Well, they should view this decision as a tool. It's not in it with, you know, with the inadequate enforcement mechanisms. It clearly is not going to be sufficient in and of itself to bring justice to the Palestinian people. But it is a tool, because the governments that support Israel routinely invoke the international legal system and international legal principles to justify what they do. So now we have this weapon which we can use against them, and we can say, even as laypersons, clearly, 15-2, all the Western judges on the ICJ found it plausible that Israel's committing genocide. You, Prime Minister Trudeau, you, President Biden, you, President Macron, you, Prime Minister Sunak, and all the rest of you Western leaders, who, you know, gravely and solemnly intone international law when it suits your purposes. Well, here you have the highest court in the United Nations system saying it's plausible Israel's committing genocide. We are now going to hold you to your word that you are defenders of the international legal order. So that's a weapon in our arsenal, which is a powerful one. In and of itself, will it bring justice to the Palestinian people? No, we're going to need to bring all of our various, we're going to have to use all of the tools in our toolkit to do that. But I have to say, David, in my opinion, when I look at the whole range of what's going on out there, it's not just the ICJ's decision. When I look at the economic impacts this is having on Israel, when I look at the axis of resistance and how it is having an impact, including the Yemenis, you know, stopping maritime traffic to the port of Eilat. When I look at global public opinion, you know, what I see is the Palestinian people are decisively winning this struggle for justice. Unfortunately, there's a lot more suffering to come, in my opinion. I hope that I'm wrong about that. But the trajectory is one that I think is very positive in the long run for the Palestinian people, more so than, you know, I've seen in my lifetime, frankly.
And the situation in Gaza is dreadful. In closing, my last comment, watching Al Jazeera, as I do all the time, and the scenes from the, you know, the few hospital wards that are still functioning with blood all over the floor, and now these tens of thousands of Palestinians all crowded into this tiny little enclave near Rafah, and it's raining, it's the winter time, and all their tents are being flooded, and their little kids kind of walking in puddles, and there's no food, and there's disease is rampant. I was just reading, you know, diarrheal diseases. The incidence of diarrheal diseases in Gaza has risen, I think, 20-fold. It's a nightmare.
It is. It's unspeakable. There are no words, really. I wake up every morning, David, and I force myself to watch Al Jazeera for an hour because I can't help the Palestinian people if I don't bear witness to their suffering. But it's extremely, I mean, I can't, just watching it is devastating. To actually live it and to be the subject of these horrors is, I can't even imagine that. But we have to bear witness. We must continue to tell the story of the Palestinian people here in the West. Without Western support, this war, this devastation, these horrors will come to an end in a New York minute.
Dimitri Lascaris, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you very much, David. Always a pleasure.
Dimitri Lascaris is a lawyer, activist, and journalist based in Montreal and Greece. I'll link to Dimitri's web blog at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.